case 99-2980-CR State v. Shuttlesworth. Justice Sykes is, may have anticipated not sitting in light of the fact that she was the trial judge, and I would like to disclose that I was chair of the National Institute of Justice Commission on the Future of DNA Evidence, and also a member of the DNA Advisory Board. The commission was appointed under the auspices of the National Institute of Justice, U.S. Department of Justice. Mr. Travis was chair, Jen Arena was attorney general. I was also on a member of the DNA Advisory Board. That was an FBI appointment, I believe, which related to standards for laboratories. In both commissions, statistical evidence was often discussed. All the proceedings were totally open and appeared on the DNA Commission on the internet, available to everybody. I abstained in both cases from voting on any issue that I thought was a legal issue that might come forward. But these discussions were discussed. The other thing that I realized as I went through the briefs, but I have not read the record, was that I know Bruce Bedoli, who has an affidavit in the appendix, very well, having worked with him over any number of years on these commissions. I am at the moment sitting, but if on further reflection, looking at the record and the issues of the case, I may withdraw from participation if either one of counsel has anything to add to what I have just stated, and they should advise me as to my participation in the case. I don't know the extent to which the National Research Council's second report, of which James Crowe, Professor Emeritus of Genetics chair, comes into play here, but James Crowe is a long-time personal friend. If I have failed to disclose anything that I think is significant on further reflection, I will do so, but at least as of this moment, from my knowledge of the case, that is my disclosure, and as I said, at the moment I am participating. I withdraw and either one of you have any objections to my sitting or anything you want to reveal, let me know to make it to which you would do that. So we will now have Nia Safarbi from the law offices of Stephen Epstein argue for Mr. Shuttlesworth.
My name is Mia Safarbi. I practice with the law offices of Stephen M. Epstein. I was appointed to represent Mr. Shuttlesworth on appeal. Very briefly, Mr. Shuttlesworth was at one time charged in this case in a 17-count information that involved three complainants, but by the day of trial, that had been reduced to six counts, and it involved two complainants. And I think I'm supposed to refer to them by their first names. They have the same last initial, but they're not related. So they're Brandy F. and Thomasine F. They both asserted they had been offered or forced into rides in a black blazer and were then sexually assaulted. And as to Brandy, the sexual assault charges were one count of penis-to-vagina intercourse, parenthetically stated to be from the front, and one count of penis to vagina intercourse from the rear. There was also a kidnapping charge. And as to Thomasine, the sexual assault charges were one count of sexual contact between Thomasine and Mr. Shuttlesworth's penis, and one count of penis to vagina intercourse. And this case arose when, about 2 months after her complaint was made, Brandy saw a black blazer on the road, looked in, believed that she recognized the driver as her assailant, wrote down the plates, told the police. The blazer turned out to be the Shuttlesworth vehicle. It was actually owned by his girlfriend, now his wife. Mr. Shuttlesworth was then arrested, and Brandy and Thomasine both identified him in a lineup. One more brief factual background. There was DNA evidence in the case as to both of them, and the FBI DNA lab performed the analysis, and in September of 1996, it issued two reports, one as to each, and disclosed substantial underlying data. And as to Brandy, it disclosed the odds of selecting an unrelated individual at random, having a DNA profile from these genetic loci matching the source of the DNA from the obtained from the question specimens as approximately 1 in 10 billion from the black population, 1 in 7.5 billion from the Caucasian population, and 1 in 3.8 billion from the southeastern Hispanic population. And for Thomasine, the probabilities were even higher, 1 in 7.4 trillion from the black population, 1 in 9.1 trillion from the Caucasian population, 1 in 2.9 trillion from the southeastern Hispanic, and 1 in 510 billion. But then 4 days from the southwestern Hispanic population. Then 4 days before trial, the state sent the defense a supplementary report which indicated that because there was a match, that there was a match at these six loci, and that based on these results, Shuttlesworth is the source of DNA obtained from the specimen to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. And certainly defense counsel understood that to mean that statistics would not be presented by the state in the Thomasine case, and the state agreed that that was the case when they had a motion in limine hearing the day of trial. Our first issue is that there was a discovery violation. And the trouble with claiming a discovery violation is often that you don't know exactly what you're missing. And that has been true in this case. But Mr. Shuttlesworth believes that the state was required to submit whatever preceded its ability to substitute a uniqueness assertion, which the state calls a source attribution, for a statistical statement. The FBI and the state have been taking the position that all this is a policy change, that they just decided that they were going to say one thing instead of the other. But it's our position that the submissions reflect that there is something, some kind of calculation, some kind of assessment that underlies that change. Dr. Badoli submitted an affidavit on post-conviction where he specifically says that the conclusion about source attribution is case-dependent. And then he gives some examples of what case-dependent means. And he gives the example of supposing we know the number of people who have access to the scene and we can rule one out. And that's really not, that really isn't genetic. That's not because there's a six loci match. That's because someone has considered the number of people with access to the scene. And that's not the only fact that would necessarily be part of what it means to be case dependent. And the state in its brief summarized some of the facts that might have been considered, like driving a black blazer, but that again, it's not genetic. Dr. Zabel, sure.
I need some help on this. Your primary focus with regard to the discovery violation is 972.11, is that correct?
Yes.
Yesterday, the state provided us with a letter that in part advised the court that 972.11 has been repealed. I think the letter says effective August 31st.
I checked that on the internet, and that does seem to be true.
Was it replaced with anything?
It appears that they're anticipating that 923, that the regular discovery statute is going to cover it, and the language in 923, I can't remember the statute, sorry, the regular discovery statute in criminal cases has both for the defense burden and the state burden the line deleted where it used to say that 97211 doesn't apply to that statute. That line has been deleted, so it would appear that going forward the regular discovery statute, which requires disclosure of reports, is going to apply. But at the time it didn't.
If the focus of your petition is a violation of 97211, and thus we're required to construe 97211, why should the court not just improvidently grant this case? In other words, say that we're not going to decide it. We shouldn't have taken it because the statute has changed, and the statute is the essence of this case.
Well, it's only one issue. We have some other issues.
I might be irreverent in saying this, but it seems to me that some of the other issues are kind of tag-along issues, issues that this court may not normally take in and of itself, but it is, the DNA issue, the 972-11 issue, that appears to me to be the paramount issue in this case. Am I wrong?
Well, the objection by counsel was tagged to 972-11.
You've couched in your argument 972-11, I think, and case law. I mean, should we say, okay, 972-11 isn't going to carry the day because it doesn't exist anymore, and our interpretation of it is not of great moment. But what about case law? Should that be carrying the day for you?
Well, the thing is that the state is taking the position that this was just a policy change, and that that the FBI didn't need to disclose what was underneath, no matter what. They're saying it's just their ultimate opinion. And so the same issue is going to come up when you look at the regular discovery statute, because there's still a requirement to disclose reports. There's still a requirement to do all of the things you would usually expect from an expert, but you may not have to do that. In fact, the state specifically argues that under the regular discovery statute, which I really wish I could remember the name so I didn't keep saying that, you just give me a second. I'll just find that number. 971-23, that under 971-23, like under every other discovery statute, there is no obligation to disclose this kind of information. And we're saying, yes, there is under this statute, because it is a report, it is a process, it is a procedure, it is part of the steps that went into this DNA analysis, and that's going to come up every time they make this presentation, and I assume they're going to do it again, although whether they have so far, I don't know. There hasn't been a case that I found exactly like it. And there's also a due process problem.
Counsel, just to refresh my memory, just what wasn't disclosed? Are you complaining? First of all, as I understand it, you received a report about a year from trial. Then you received this supplemental report 4 days, which was supplementary. And was there information in there that, is that what you're complaining about, that was pertinent and you did not have it timely? It seemed to me it was just supplementary to the main. You received the information a year ahead of time.
There is no dispute, there's no doubt, they received a huge amount of data a year ahead of time.
Could you speak up, please?
What?
That was great.
sorry. My apologies. I was having a little difficulty hearing you.
I got it now. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Mark that down, someone.
That was a great moment of support.
All right. Let's see. 4 days before trial, the state indicated the FBI was not going to testify to this statistical conclusion. They didn't say, we're not going to testify to the statistical conclusion, but it was pretty obvious that that's what they were saying. Instead, they said, there is a 6 loci match, and they'd already disclosed that. Based on that, Shuttlesworth is the source of this specimen to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. The fact that that came 4 days before trial in and of itself is a problem, but the secondary problem, equally large, is that there's something underneath there. We don't know how they got to source attribution. We have some guesses. Dr. Zabel's report, which is appended to the brief, spells out he's been at the Promega conference where Dr. Badoli talked about this theory. There's been speculation among experts in this field as to how you might get to source attribution. NRC 2 says we think that at some point when it would become unreasonable to assume that no two people in the world would have the same profile, you might be able to talk about source attribution. But we know that you're not there. We're not there at 6 loci. It's not unreasonable to assume that two people will have the same picture at 6 loci. And we know that they're talking about non-genetic information also, because Dr. Badoli tells us that in his affidavit.
It just seemed to me, and maybe this is because I'm not an expert in this, and I just, we've been to one or two, I would say seminars that explain this to us, so we understand it, but it just seems to me, gosh, I would say, oh my, if this information, I'm talking about statistics, had come before the jury, and they're talking about trillions, it would have been it's something that it really wouldn't complain about, but what you're saying is that there's something underneath this, underneath their decision.
Yes.
And that you didn't, are you saying that you didn't have an adequate notice of it?
We've never seen it.
You never say, okay.
We don't know what's under there. There's a quote that's in Dr. Zabel, that's my statistics expert, affidavit, where someone made inquiry of Dr. Badoli and got the answer, well, I can't remember the formula offhand. But there's a formula under there. There's something else that lets them get to a statement of uniqueness/source attribution. I believe it has to do with selection of facts, non-genetic facts, but that's just the conclusion that I'm drawing as a lawyer and a non-scientist from the affidavit that's been submitted talking about the fact that it's case-specific. There's something that we didn't receive that seems pretty critical. And the reason that it's so critical is that when an expert gets up and says, that's his, you really need to be able to impeach that if you can. And in this case, they could have shown, if they had the information in advance and had been alerted, at least with some advance notice, they could have undertaken to get an expert to show that you're not at that point with 6 loci.
Counsel, are you done answering? 97211, sub 5B, 2. Requires the disclosure of 5 things. That's the subject of this case, right? Which of those 5 are you claiming they did not disclose?
Certain procedures.
And which one is that? There's A is the duplicates of actual audiographs generated, B, the laboratory protocols and procedures followed. Is that it?
Because in Nelson v. State...
Well, weren't those protocols and procedures revealed to you at least 1 year prior to the trial?
Not the procedure that took them from a statistical assertion to an assertion of uniqueness.
How do you know that a different procedure was used?
Well, that's why I started out by saying you're in a bad spot when you got a discovery problem, because you don't always know. But the way that I think I know is that Dr. Zabel, our expert, and Dr. Badoli, the state's expert, are both indicating that as far as they, well, Dr. Badoli specifically says source attribution is case dependent. So it's not just the procedures that were submitted as of September 1996. Those were just blood and math. But Dr. Badoli tells us that when they talk about case dependent, he then gives some examples, things like how many people had access to the scene. So I think that they're drawing conclusions based on some non-genetic facts, but I don't know what they are, and I don't know how they select them. And there's there are mathematical formulas that can be used. I can't translate them from math to English, so I'm not going to do that, but Dr. Zabel sets out a little bit so that you can see in his report that there are certain mathematical constructs where you might factor in other ways of calculation if you're going to take it from statistics to source that, from a statistical assertion to a uniqueness assertion. But we don't know.
Well, all of this would strike some people, maybe not me, but maybe me, as being really arguing about nothing. Because if, in fact, let's say that we would say you cannot, the FBI cannot make the statement that to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, but that they must use the statistics. Seems to me that the statistics of 1 in 7.4 trillion is as damning, if not more so, to Mr. Shuttlesworth than the statement to a reasonable degree of medical certainty.
Well, actually, he said that's his.
That's what?
The expert actually said that's his. I mean, he didn't just say reasonable degree of scientific certainty. He concluded by saying that's his.
Well,
that's...
That seems to me to be saying the same thing as 1 in 7.4 trillion. That's more than the world's population, isn't it?
Anymore. But the statistic is the probability of selecting an unrelated person at random, which is different from the probability of another person having that picture. And that's why Dr. Zabel goes through the exercise of showing thousands and thousands and thousands of sibling pairs will share at six loci. So, yes, there's a big number as far as picking an unrelated person at random, but we think that a jury understands the difference between that kind of a statistical construct and the assertion that's his. Because once they hear that's his, they're not going to hear anything else. Unless somebody goes and shows them, which they could have in this case, that you can't say that. You can't say that's his with these numbers and on these facts. And if they had known that, they could have assessed some of the facts in this case that were actually not so bad for the defense, and you might even say pretty good. There was a pubic hair that didn't match. The Thomasine actually said that the back of that vehicle with its bucket seats was not the bench seat that she was assaulted on. There was some confusion in her mind as to whether she had seen pink zigzag decals. She testified she had seen them and there was no doubt, but they weren't there on the vehicle. And then she sort of backed away from her own perception, of which she had no doubt.
Mrs. Farby, if I might interrupt for a minute, I just want to clear this up in my own mind. My understanding is that you're not here today to argue that statistical match information is required before an opinion can be given. What you seem to be arguing, as I understand it, is that this was a discovery problem here, that they didn't give you sufficiently in advance that supplemental report, and therefore you weren't prepared to adequately cross-examine the expert. Is that correct?
No, I've only had a chance to say...
Seal it in for me, because I don't understand your issue.
That's one issue. Yeah, one issue is the discovery issue. As a second issue, we also say that statistics are mandatory. They are part of DNA profile evidence, and that they have to be presented no matter what else may be part of DNA evidence. Statistical evidence is a mandatory component, and that this was not presented by the state. They elected not to present it. They said they weren't going to present it. They didn't present it.
Well, if that's your issue, it's my understanding that there is a split in jurisdictions. Some require that and some do not. Why is it better? Why is the better rule that there has to be statistical match information before you can give an opinion?
Your Honor, because the courts that have said that statistics are necessary have said because otherwise it's meaningless, because match alone is a coincidental occurrence. We all match in some ways. 99% of everyone's DNA matches, but there are also millions and millions of loci where we don't all match. But in any particular loci, there are going to be matches between you and someone else, and with two loci, fewer, and three loci, fewer. But you may match your sibling at all six loci, in fact, maybe at nine.
Why isn't that the kind of thing that could be probed on cross-examination? Why should the state be required to provide statistical match information?
Well, because the statute says that DNA evidence is admissible, and the state, in this case, was the proponent. And it's our position that DNA evidence has two components. And if you're going to present evidence, then you have to present the evidence. You can't present part of what the actual thing is. The thing, the DNA evidence that they want to present, consists of the match and the statistical probability of the match. And one alone is not DNA profile evidence, at least not under the statute. And many other cases which don't have our statute, or many other jurisdictions that don't have our statute, say that's true as a general proposition, not just under our statute.
Counsel, it seems to me that your position, that statistical evidence has to be presented, it's a mandatory component, that position has to rely on, number one, the statute, or a due process argument, or common law. The position that statistical evidence has to be presented as a mandatory component, where in the statute do you refer to give credence to that position?
The statute doesn't say it. That's why I'm dependent on a case called Armstead, which interpreted its identical statute to say that. That's the answer, and it's spelled out in the brief. I can also just say there are these other jurisdictions that come out similarly. And then we also have State versus Peters, which may have new importance. Actually, I should have thought of that. Do you want me to stop? the buttons.
You may finish the
grant. When you asked me about improvidently granted, State v. Peters is out there giving as the basis for its holding that statistics are necessary to understand match evidence. So if there's no statute, State v. Peters, which was decided before the statute, no, it was decided after the statute, but based on a case that was not under the statute, is going to be important. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Welsh, Assistant Attorney General Welsh, representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Farby, you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Diane Welsh, representing the state of Wisconsin. The state would support Justice Bradley's suggestion that perhaps this case could be dismissed as improvidently granted. In the alternative, we request that you affirm Mr. Shuttlesworth's judgment of conviction. In this case, the state did not violate any statutory or constitutional duty it had to disclose information to the defendant. The defendant received everything he asked for and everything to which he was entitled under the law. The trial court did not err in admitting relevant, helpful testimony about the DNA evidence, including the fact that Mr. Shuttlesworth's DNA profile matched the evidentiary DNA. The law requires that to be admitted, scientific evidence must be relevant and helpful to the jury. Here, the state provided both a qualitative and a quantitative explanation to assist the jury in understanding the value and significance of the DNA match evidence. The state did more than just merely assert that the DNA was the evidentiary DNA belonged to Mr. Shuttlesworth. There are pages and pages of testimony by two different state experts explaining the process of the DNA analysis, explaining the certainty of the match, and why the FBI expert could opine that the DNA, that Mr. Shuttlesworth was the source of this DNA evidence, to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. The mere fact that the state did not present a specific numerical probability statistic in the Thomasine case does not nullify the admissibility of the DNA evidence. And I think it's important to note here, if the state had been required to provide a specific number, it would have provided that number. And when we evaluate this case for harm, there's no harm here, because if it had been required to, the jury would have heard 1 in 7.4 trillion in the black population has the likelihood that a second unrelated person would have also matched that DNA evidentiary profile.
But that's the conclusion. I mean, it would seem to me, as an attorney preparing for defense, I would want your underlying statistical data in order to give it to my expert so that my expert can take apart your statistic that you're presenting. I mean, this one in heaven knows how many trillion, you know, I mean, that's tough evidence. I mean, that's strong evidence. But if you have an expert on the other side, which is saying, look, their underlying premise is correct, they can't use this as a statistic, da-da-da-da-da, and either throw it out or greatly compromise it, then maybe the defendant should be able to do that. But if you don't give them the statistic, they can't attack. They have no weapon to attack your conclusion. How do you respond to that?
The state provided all of the statistics to the defense. The defense had those numbers. And it's clear from the record, as I indicate in my brief, that the defense attorney took a leave, like got a continuance in order to consult an expert. You know, there's two references to consult, you know, that he was going to look into obtaining a defense expert and obtain a defense expert. We don't know. The record doesn't show why he didn't ultimately use a defense expert at trial. One might speculate that it's because the defense expert could not really contradict the state's expert. You know, we don't know. But all of the information, all the statistics were disclosed to the defense more than a year before trial. So this isn't an issue of the state not telling the defense what the statistics were. It's just that at trial, they didn't present a specific number related to the Thomasine case. They did use probability statistics to show how accurate or how significant the DNA match was. They talked about it in terms of, you know, the population of the world. They talked about it as a comparison to the evidence of the match in the Brandy case.
Counsel, what about assertion that, well, we need more than blood and statistics. We need information like how many people had access to the scene. We need not just the numbers, but the statistical procedures.
The underlying basis for the change in the FBI's policy is not a procedure. It's based on the state of the science and the law at that time. It's based on the 1996 NRC publication. It was based on how courts were accepting the probability statistics at the time, or the databases that supported the probability statistics. That is, you know, it's all of the information that was out there in the forensic community related to DNA evidence. It's, you know, widely available on the internet through publications. So in terms of that, what lied underneath the FBI policy, it's this huge body of knowledge and nothing that the state had within its exclusive possession that it should be required to disclose to the other side. You know, if asked for the FBI policy, you know, there's no reason to believe that that wouldn't have been turned over. The state was never asked for the FBI policy. So, I mean, I don't understand what's missing, what we really didn't give. In terms of understanding, you know, where the science was at in 1997, it's hard to go back and see, you know, what exactly would have been available, but we know for certain that the 1996 NRC publication was out there, which does not state that a statement of source attribution is impermissible. Again, it may talk about a statement of uniqueness being outside the current technology at that time, but our expert did not say that the DNA profile at those six loci was unique. It said that to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty that, you know, that DNA semen came from Mr. Shuttlesworth. That's a different statement.
No, I understand that, was it 972.11 sub 5 has been repealed?
Yes.
What is the state of the law following the repeal? What information would have to be turned over?
What that has done, it's 972.11 sub 5 related specifically to RFLP analysis, which is the type of DNA analysis that was used in this case and was historically used. So the law statutes have now been broadened to cover other forms, any form of DNA analysis. And it has shifted then from the specific requirements of that section to the general requirements of the general discovery statute in terms of what would need to be disclosed.
Justice Bradley asked a question about the probability statistics. You indicated, well, those were turned over in
yes.
this case. Would they be turned over in the future?
Yes, if requested, they'd be turned over.
If they're requested, they would be turned over under the general discovery statute.
Yes. And actually,
irrespective of whether they're actually used, they would be turned over.
Right. Even if the state didn't intend to admit them, you present them into evidence, if the state intended to do it in a qualitative explanation versus using a specific number, the state would still be obligated to turn over the probability statistics.
I'm having another one of my obtuse mornings, and I wonder if you would take a shot at summarizing what you think your opponent is trying to get at, on what wasn't timely turned over, wasn't turned over. What is it she's saying?
What I understand it to be is the information that underlies the FBI policy change. And what I, and in that, you know, that would be information that the policymakers at the FBI had, knowledge, discussions, scientific publications, presentations. You know, I don't know beyond that, other than the state of the science and the law at that time, what it is specifically. I want to note that, you know, it comes across as a big breakthrough that the FBI was at that point willing to attribute SOARs. Other experts that didn't work for the FBI were attributing SOARs before this trial. You know, just in looking through some cases, experts from CellMark, which was a very commonly used DNA analysis lab, would testify that the defendant was the source of DNA prior to this time. In a Michigan case in 1994, State versus Plume, indicated that if the statistics supported it, an expert could testify that the defendant was or was not the source of the evidentiary DNA. So although it was novel in this case, this was the first case where an FBI expert was authorized by policy to attribute source. It was happening in other DNA cases around the country by other DNA experts.
Well, what's the normal practice now in the trial courts of Wisconsin? Is it normal now to follow what was done in this particular case? In other words, to have testimony to the effect that to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, there is a match here?
If the probability statistics support that statement, the experts are doing it. I verified our crime lab now does DNA analysis, and our crime lab experts will testify as to source if the numbers support it. You know, the DNA technology has advanced since 1996, and now we currently use a form of technology where the numbers are routinely in the trillions. And so our crime lab experts will testify as to their opinion if the defendant is the source.
Has this been challenged in any other cases that you're aware of, this practice, this procedure?
We've not seen it in our office, so I don't know if it's happening at the trial court level. But I think what's appropriate, where it's appropriate to challenge it, if at all, is through cross-examination. And here, if it would have been helpful, but is that really a valid attack? I mean, here there's no attack on the chain of custody or contamination. You know, there's no indication that Mr. Shuttlesworth really doesn't match the evidentiary DNA found on both these victims. You know, there's no indication that we should test additional loci just to make sure this is accurate. All this is an attack on, it's mere semantics. It really is purely an academic attack, and I don't know if that attempt to confuse the jury or obfuscate the issue really would have been helpful to the defendant in this case.
Ms. Wilk, may you finish your
statement? Yes.
Justice Crooks. You indicated early that you supported, you were supportive of this court improvidently granting. I'd like to know why. It strikes me that the state, assuming that you would prevail here, the state might well like a statement this court rather than an unpublished opinion of the Court of Appeals, that this is okay.
And that's fine. And
well, is it fine or is
no, we
what would
you
we
prefer? Would, and that would be preferable, but I don't know if it's the state of the law. I don't think Peter's stance supports the proposition that it's being used for. I mean, that case, the question before the court was, is the evidence admissible? And the court ruled, yes, it is admissible. It didn't indicate it was a prerequisite to the admissibility of DNA match evidence. So, yes, an opinion from this court clarifying the state of DNA law would be helpful, you know, whether it's necessary to tie up your resources to affirm a court of appeals opinion, which is essentially correct, you know, that would be your decision.
Would the only reason, I want to just explore this, would the only reason to be writing an opinion on this then to be to address the Peters case?
I think so.
That language in the Peters case.
9-11-5 is no longer practiced. The state has no, I think so. And even if you would go the other way and decide that specific numerical probability is required in every state, in every case. The state is not strongly opposed to that, although we don't believe that is what the law says or what the law is in Wisconsin's, under Wisconsin's rule of evidence. But we can do that. You know, we have no dispute that we have to present scientific evidence that's helpful to the jury. And that, you know, but we want to make clear that we did do that in this case. You know, this is not a case where the expert got on the stand, said it's his, it's his DNA, and sat down. You know, there's pages and pages of testimony. So I think, you know, if the opinion clarifies the holding of Peters, you know, that would be useful. It's hard because forensic science is an ever-evolving field, and, you know, the state of DNA today is going to be different than it will be in 3 years from now. So it's hard to pinpoint exactly what the standard should be in a way that will hold water in the future.
This is on this issue. This is a per curiam opinion, and I've read it, but I'm just kind of reviewing it again, and it looks like the only real discussion on the law is the statute 972.11.5, which has been repealed, the Peters case, and then the general cases referring to the Frye test, but Wisconsin does it under Steve versus Walston, that is the general scientific expert testimony rules. So the only case is Peters in the whole discussion on this issue. And it's your position that the Court of Appeals unpublished current opinion got it right, obviously.
Yes.
Was statistical probabilities part of the underlying foundation testified to by your experts?
Yes.
With respect to both of the women?
They gave the specific numbers as they related to Brandy, and then when they testified about the evidence found with Thomasine, they said, you know, I believe like one of the numbers with Brandy was 1 in 10 billion. And they said, as a comparison, you know, the probability that a second unrelated person would match in this case is even less likely than this probability. So I think that is using a probability statistic. You know, it logically shows the jury that it's even less likely than 1 in 10 billion. And I think that explains it. Here where you have multiple victims and you're throwing out numbers like 1 in 10 billion, 1 in 7.4 trillion, you know, 1 in 7.4 trillion all of a sudden makes 1 in 10 billion look small, when we all know that's not, it's very, very unlikely that a second person would match at those loci. I mean, that is one of the motivations for the prosecutor to not give specific numbers in both cases, but to give the lower numbers and then to say, and in the second case, it's even less likely, you know, so as not to confuse the jury. And I think that's another, you know, point that, you know, scientific evidence could be excluded when it will confuse the jury. And, you know, I think it was a tactical decision that a prosecutor or any party who's proposing this type of evidence can make. And again, if the defense wants to call it into question or point out, well, what are the real numbers? What, you know, the defense can do so. In this case, prudently, defense counsel did not do that because the numbers weren't helpful. Had the numbers been 1 in 100, then perhaps those should have been brought out on cross-examination. So I don't think we can attack trial counsel's performance as being deficient for not pointing out the, you know, extreme unlikelihood that any second person would also match it, you know, the profile of the evidentiary DNA. If the court has no further questions, the state will, you know, rest on its brief. And again, we respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of conviction entered below, you know, or alternatively, you dismiss the petition. Thank you.
Ms. Farby, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Well, what happened was that trial counsel really didn't touch the statement, "That's his." He just really didn't touch it. And he did explore some very specific loci relating to Brandy and the numbers that related to Brandy, and the transcript reflects that the jury was probably aware that there were other numbers from that same loci that Dr. Callahan was indicating were different, but not significantly different, completely insignificantly different, that related to Thomasine. But the specific numbers always being discussed had to do with Brandy. And so sitting out there for the jury on the Thomasine case was, that's his. And so it's our position that what reason is there to think that the jury is going to pay any attention to these other facts when not only does the state's FBI expert say that's his, but trial counsel doesn't even go after it. And if they had had advance notice or whatever it is that underlied being able to say that, they could have at least showed that in 1997 at least, or 1997, you really couldn't make that statement just based on a six loci match. And that's what was unfair. That's the due process problem, and that's the discovery violation. Regarding uniqueness versus source attribution, Dr. Callahan testified that except for identical twins, everybody has a DNA picture that's different. Then he says, that DNA is his. So, okay. I think that that's a uniqueness statement, because if everyone's entire DNA picture is different, and that's his DNA, then that DNA is uniquely his. It may also be a source attribution statement, but it's obviously also, to me, a uniqueness statement. I don't see a big difference there. I'm not sure I have anything else to say, Your Honor.
Are there any further questions? Are there any further questions? No. Well, thank you, Ms. Safarbi, and thank you, Ms. Welsh, for your arguments today. And that closes the hearing on 99-29-CR State versus Shuttlesworth. And I will call the second case.